From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for being with us this week. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's open the week with a powerful story of a mother of four. Her oldest child is transgender. Her third child is gender expansive. She's had to learn a lot about what exactly that means, but one thing has been constant. Pamela Dayton loves her children deeply and will do anything to protect them.
This week, we discussed how parents react to finding out that their child is part of the LGBTQ community. Here's Pamela telling her story.
I am the mother of four boys. My oldest is transgender, and my second and fourth are cis and straight, and my number three is a gender expansive person.
Gender expansive is a term that I think some of our listeners, I'm not sure I could perfectly describe the full spectrum, which I think is, again, part of a process for a lot of parents especially. So for your child, what does that mean?
My child was assigned male at birth and does not feel all the way male and does not feel all the way female. My child just feels like a person and isn't really comfortable identifying as one or the other. He's just comfortable being himself. Gender's a wide and varied spectrum. Pinpointing where you are in that spectrum is often really difficult for people. And one of the things we were talking about before, like why there's so many more people out now than maybe when I was a kid or when you were kids, we have a vocabulary to talk about this now. And that vocabulary, I never heard transgender when I was a child. I never heard gender binary. I never heard non-binary or asexual. That just wasn't any part of our conversation. But now there's so much more information and there's so much more research been done that children are having a much better way to express who they are as human beings. And as a parent of people who need that vocabulary, I'm really grateful it exists.
Your oldest child is a transgender boy.
Yep.
When did that conversation, when did you know that that was the case?
He told me pretty clearly. He left me a note on the bathroom counter. I think I can speak to my reaction.
So let's take through your reaction then.
I wasn't surprised. I wasn't not surprised. I kind of just received the information and then I started doing some research. And the first thing that came up, like Karen mentioned, was a suicide attempts and completion. And 40% of transgender adults say they have attempted suicide. And 92% of those people have attempted before they were age 25, which is really scary to think about. So it was pretty clear early on to me that supporting my child was not a question. I want my kid to stay alive. And I mean, that informed my reaction. And that was how I framed it, the situation, when other people were told, like, look, you can be on team, keep my kid healthy and alive, or you can hit the road because I got no space for this anymore. And people understand that language. Because it's not like my kid is making this choice. It's not like it's a phase. Like, that's a question that I get all the time. And I'm rubbing my hand against my forehead right now because, like, it's not a phase. Like, they're not going to snap out of it. They're not going to grow out of it. They're not going to, like, kids are growing into who they are. They're not growing out of something. They're finding their place and their role and...
Well, yeah. Especially when it's, what is this phrase? Consistent, persistent, insistent.
Yeah.
And that was obviously the case in your family.
Yeah, that was definitely the case in my family.
And how's he doing now?
He's doing really well, I think. Yeah, he's a good kid. I like him a lot. He's super funny. You gonna keep him then? I'm an adopted person. I'm definitely keeping my children. Oh, my goodness.
Your third child, as you said, is gender expansive.
Yes.
That conversation, was that also, was it around the same time? Was it considerably years later? Can you take me through, again, more your reaction than the story of the child?
My number three has always been gender expansive, would prefer the dress-up dresses, the bell gown, the flower girl dresses that we had, the anything twirly and fluffy and fancy and fabulous. And that's just always been who that kid is and continues to be. So there was not any option to change that. Like, there was, like, changing that was never a question because he was just so fully obvious that that was just part of that kid's identity. So you go with it because that's what you do when you're a parent.
And how are things going for your third child?
All right. They're all right.
Good.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Did you have fears about the school environment? About bullying, about other things?
My kids switched schools this year, and the school that they used to attend is in a much different community than the community where we live now. And my kid was like the first out, really out kid, the first trans kid at the school. And I spent a lot of time on the phone last year calling people and saying, is this what you said? And let's talk about the impact of that, and let's talk about how illegal that is. New York State has the Dignity for All Schools Students Act, where you can report bullying. I think I earned my frequent flyer miles on the DASA forms last year. There was kind of a lot of bullying. At one point, a different kid in the school had gotten assaulted, and the kid's parents weren't the kind to call and ask questions about that, but I am. So I called, and the assistant principal said, well, if that child hadn't been wearing a pride flag tied around her neck, maybe she wouldn't have gotten pulled down the stairs with it. And I said,
this is the assistant principal?
It was the acting assistant principal said that. I had a real loud conversation with her, which was pretty much one-sided. But this year, the school that we're in, totally a non-issue. From registering until right now, the teachers are great. There was one teacher who was sort of fishing for information, and that got shut down pretty quick.
Because it's nobody's business?
Because it's not your business.
Yeah.
My kid wears clothes, and that's what you get to see. You don't get to ask questions about people's genitalia and who people want to sleep with. Like, no. Super against the law. You can't do that.
Sorry about that, but I'm glad to hear the experience this year has been more positive.
It has been much more positive.
And
and I'm pretty sure that's not ever going to happen at that other school again, so that's real good.
Next, an epic battle between insects. You've probably had an encounter or two with a stink bug in your home. They're just about everywhere, destroying crops and hiding themselves in homes, especially in the cold weather. But there's some good news. We're releasing samurai wasps to kill them. Yay! Sounds like a plan, right?
Says the man who is deathly afraid of wasps.
No.
You are.
I was riding a bicycle when I was a teenager, and I was wearing jean shorts because jean shorts are
super cool.
Are very cool.
If you're Evan Dawson.
Or if you're anybody. And a wasp flew into my jean shorts right inside my thigh and stung me repeatedly while I was on a bicycle.
I had a bee get stuck in a sports bra once, but I survived.
What do you expect a young person to do with a wasp in their jean shorts? You're going to have a bit of a concern about wasps forever. Plus, wasps are not nice.
Okay, well, anyway, researchers say unleashing samurai wasps on stink bugs is actually a good plan. The tiny samurai wasps are the natural predators of the brown marmorated stink bug. Scientists are using them to infiltrate stink bug eggs and kill the pests. The method has some listeners asking if releasing one species to kill another can be effective. In this clip, you'll hear from Jack Warren, a biology professor at the University of Rochester, and from Peter Jentsch, an entomologist from Cornell University. Peter's up first, discussing if there could be any unintended consequences.
Those are really important questions, and Kim Holmner, sort of going back to that as a reference, the lab that he works in, that he's director of, they see that as a really important question. So his prospects with regards to trying to find the most effective and the most specifically designed wasp, if you will, to counter brown marmorated stink bug was at the heart of his investigations. So when he ran his studies, he looked at samurai wasps in lots of different ways. One was providing the samurai wasp with a choice between brown armored stink bug eggs and lots of other stink bugs, and found that when given a choice, these wasps prefer brown marmorated stink bug. So this is really a huge question with regards to biological control, because in the wild, as was already pointed out, the parasitoids really do play a huge role, and they're natives in our country already. I mean, they've evolved here. So we have a huge array of biological controls that are predators, that are parasites, that are parasitoids already at play, trying to reduce brown marmorated stink bug as well as other pests that we have. But this one wasp in particular is just extremely successful in that it lays its eggs in brown marmorated stink bug, but not just one or two. It will kill off the entire cluster of 28 brown marmorated stink bug eggs at one shot. And along with that, it does, when not given a choice, it does oviposit, lay its eggs in other stink bugs, one in particular that's a concern, and that is the spine soldier bug. So that's one of the deficits in this system. However, as I said earlier, the native stink bugs generally will oviposit into other biological control organisms as well. So it's not that different than what we find here with our native population of parasitoids.
Okay, Jack, you want to add to that?
Yeah, these are kind of referred to as off-target effects. And there are a number of horror stories in the past when biological control was in its infancy, where people would introduce an organism. And then it would cause lots of problems. A classic example is the cane toad in Australia, which became a huge problem that was originally introduced to feed on grubs, and there are some other of these horror stories, and that's one of the early horror stories. So that's one of the reasons why scientists in this field are much, much more careful in assessing, trying to go for more specific biological control agents rather than generalists, and doing detailed studies beforehand. But the other point I'd like to make is we really need to put this in perspective, and sometimes we lose this perspective. That is, we have to compare using an agent like this, a biological control agent, as opposed to what we're doing now. And what we do now is we use many, many thousands of tons of neurotoxins that we put into the environment to control pests with huge off-target effects. They basically kill everything. They have negative health effects on farmers, and they have negative health effects on people in rural communities. They get into our water supply. So they have all these huge off-target effects.
The various sprays you're talking about?
Oh, yes. All of the insecticides, most of them are neurotoxic, and others have other biological consequences. Not all of them are neurotoxins, but the effect is huge, and yet we just accept that, and then we get, I think, sometimes overly concerned about using a biological agent that is oftentimes its worst off-target effects do not even compare to a pesticide.
Okay. Peter, you agree with that?
Oh, that's at the very heart of the matter. Jack, you really put that well, because not only is brown marmorated stink bug prolificous, it feeds on so many different kinds of plants. Across agriculture, it feeds on vegetables, it feeds on different kinds of tree fruits, apples, peaches, pears, plums, nectaries, cherries. Jalapeno peppers are really its favorite. So you have growers that are having to bear the brunt of this invasive just really due to our commerce with China and other parts of Asia. So now the growers are faced with these invasive insects that they alone have to counter, and their only measures that are effective is the use of late-season pesticides. And when you begin to spray pesticides in August, September, October, November, what you're doing is you're leaving behind residue on foods that, you know, certainly are going to have its impact. And so that's what we're trying to avoid with integrated pest management strategies. And the use of a biological control, as Jack pointed out, is maybe the lesser of many other impacts which have a much higher degree of impact.
I want to ask you, Peter, when you think about using samurai wasps to try to eradicate a population of marmorated stink bug, you know, Jack raised the toad that went after the grubs in Australia and had unintended consequences, and there are probably other examples. Is there a worst case scenario here, Peter? Because I'm not asking you as a way to sort of be provocative. I'm asking you because I think for listeners who hear this and think enough to actually write on a news website, boy, they haven't thought things through. I'm sure researchers are thinking things through. I'm sure scientists are very concerned about intended and unintended consequences. Is there a worst case scenario here, even if it's improbable, that you can think of with using samurai wasps in this way?
So just to confirm and reinforce the fact that this wasp is already here, and it was not introduced purposely by researchers. Okay, so that being understood, it's presently in Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, West Virginia, North Carolina, New York, Oregon, Washington. It came into all of those locations on its own. Okay, so that being the foundation of this, the work that we're doing is simply moving it to places, particularly agricultural sites, where it's actually going to have an impact on the brown marmorated stink bug population over time to reduce the amount of pesticide loads that we're presently using to control that one insect. So that said, is there a worst case scenario? We're actually in a best case scenario with this particular insect because it's so specific.
All right, let's close this week with a discussion about God and meaning. Specifically, we're talking about how atheists feel about the concept of meaning. Our panel reacted to an article written by Catholic writer Andrew Sullivan, who contends that all human beings are religious in some way, even atheists.
In this clip, you'll hear Ty Gagnon, who has degrees in philosophy and theology. He's an atheist who has a lot to say about whether every person needs some sort of religious community. And he spoke about how to find meaning, whether human beings are obligated to spend their time serving others.
To be part of a group doesn't make that group religious, or to want to belong to a group doesn't mean you're joining some religion just because, you know, you want to be a part of this thing. And the broader issue for me, especially conflating meaning with religion, is that it relegates meaning to an external source.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah. So to say that the only way for me as an individual to find meaning is to join a group, to believe something that somebody else believes, to practice some practices that other people believe or that other people practice, that I have to do something external or join into something outside of myself in order to find meaning, instead of saying that it's possible for me to find meaning within my own life as an individual. You know, you spend 95% of your time playing Pokemon, and there's nothing in the world that I can tell that says you should or shouldn't do that. If you have some responsibility to another person, maybe that's not a good use of your time.
Just the devil's advocate. I like bringing in the devil in a conversation about atheism. I'll play devil's advocate and say, even if you don't have someone that you're sort of beholden to, helping raise a child, helping care for a sick parent, et cetera, you could make the argument that with your gifts in life, that's not a good use of almost all of your time because you could be doing more to help society. Again, I'm just throwing this out there. I don't know that I feel that way.
Sure. I don't know that every person needs to help society. That's okay. You know, not everybody has to be an activist. Not everybody has to be an artist. Not everybody has to be, quote, productive. That's in the sort of broadest sense of meaning. I can't tell anybody to live their life any particular way, I don't think.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370 from noon to 2, also on WRUR 88.5 FM, and on WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.